Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, PLO leader Yasser Arafat and Palestinian Prime Minister-designate Mahmoud Abbas, who's also known as Abu Mazen, have announced agreement on the makeup of a Palestinian cabinet, a step of considerably more importance than just Palestinian political inside baseball. The U.S. has made it clear that without a new Palestinian government, the Bush administration would not help reignite Arab-Israeli peace talks. We're joined now from Jerusalem by Molly Moore. She's a correspondent for The Washington Post. Hello, Molly.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks much for talking to us. Molly, the key sticking point here seemed to be whether Prime Minister Abbas would get the security chief he wanted and Arafat did not. A man named Mohammed Dahlan. Is Mr. Dahlan in the cabinet?
He is in the cabinet, although this was really the litmus test for a much greater power struggle between the two of them. Arafat is not real fond of Dahlan because he left Arafat's government last year after disagreements with the two. But at a greater issue here is a dividing up of power between Yasser Arafat, who's had ultimate and total control of the Palestinian Authority, and a prime minister who was basically foisted on him by the international community, who said, you had to relinquish some of your power or we're not going to assist in the peace process.
So is Abu Mazen the winner here?
Well, he's the winner today. However, everyone out here is expressing great caution that this is not the best way to start a relationship. Abu Mazen and Arafat have not spoken to each other since last Saturday until this afternoon. The head of intelligence for the Egyptian government was brought in to help mediate between the two. They wouldn't speak on the telephone. Arafat wouldn't speak on the telephone to Abu Mazen. They wouldn't meet in person. There was a huge amount of shuttle diplomacy this afternoon between Arafat's bombed-out compound in Ramallah and Abu Mazen's home and office. And finally, an agreement was reached largely through the help of this intermediary. Arafat had been bombarded with telephone calls from everyone, from Tony Blair, from presidents, from prime ministers, from foreign ministers from around the world, trying to get him to acquiesce and make things work with Abu Mazen.
So is it much ado, though, about something? Is the new cabinet a house cleaning? Will it be cleaner, a reformist cabinet, or not?
Well, the reformers in the Palestinian Authority say no. They say, in fact, this is one of their problems with Abu Mazen, that he put many of the same old faces back in the cabinet, and that they would like to have seen a much more reformist cabinet. But one of the key things this does do is put the security services, which are critical here to the peace process, under Abu Mazen's authority. Now, what everyone here notes is going to be very important, that, in fact, the person that may decide whether Abu Mazen succeeds or fails is not Yasser Arafat, but Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel, because they point out that Sharon is going to have to let up on some of the curfews, he's going to have to let up on some of the restrictions so that the Palestinian security forces can actually do their job in order for Abu Mazen to be able to function properly in his role as a prime minister and head of the security services along with Dahlan.
So, Molly, in the minute or so we have left, what about the old lion, President Arafat? He's 72 years old. Has he finally ceded real power, or will he still ultimately be pulling all the important strings?
Well, many people here believe that in the end he ultimately will be pulling the important strings, and this is going to be the power play between the two of them. And what Egypt, the United Nations, the European Union, the United States are all trying to convince Arafat is that he needs to cede some of this power. So everyone here expects a struggle over the next weeks, the next months, the next years, perhaps, between Abu Mazen and Yasser Arafat, because no one believes Arafat will give up these powers easily.
Molly Moore, thanks so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Molly Moore is a correspondent for The Washington Post, and she joined us from Jerusalem.
France. Democrats has proposed an immediate suspension of U.N. trade sanctions against Iraq. The Bush administration had already called for an end to the sanctions. Joining us on the line is Los Angeles Times U.N. correspondent Maggie Farley. Hi, Maggie.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine. Give us some context. What does the France call mean?
They have proposed suspending, not lifting, sanctions, and there's an important difference there. Remember, the sanctions were implemented in 1991 to pressure Saddam Hussein to give up his weapons of mass destruction. Now the U.S. is arguing that Saddam is gone, so the sanctions should disappear too. But France and other members of the Council want to keep the U.N.'s control of the Iraq economy alive in some form to counter U.S. dominance in Iraq. And really, that the Oil for Food program, which has controlled the sale of oil and the distribution of food in Iraq for the last dozen years, is the only leverage that France and other countries have right now.
The Oil for Food program was instituted in reaction to the effect of the sanctions on Iraq. So what does France propose happen to it?
They say they want to phase it out step by step. And the U.S. actually agrees on that. They also want to see it disappear and agree that you can't just cut the umbilical cord, as the head of the Oil for Food program said yesterday.
The U.S. call to end sanctions entirely is being interpreted in different ways by people. Some are saying it's to free up the oil so that it could be used to rebuild Iraq's economy. Some are saying it's a cynical move to get the U.N. out of Iraq faster so that the U.S. would have control of the oil.
Well, to end sanctions immediately without any conditions would have both of those effects. And that's why France is saying, let's suspend them and keep some sort of U.N. role in the economy. They want the U.N. to oversee the sale of oil, for instance, and to keep distributing food throughout the country because they say that only the U.N. knows how to do that.
Right. Russia's ambassador, meanwhile, said his country would not be opposed to France's suggestion of the suspension, but they want to abide by the U.N. resolutions which call for inspectors to first verify that Iraq is free of all nuclear and biological weapons. What's been the reaction from the U.S. to that?
Washington is saying, thanks very much, but we don't need any help. They have 1,000 inspectors ready to go to visit 3,000 sites. They say that Blix's team only had 100, and if you brought those 100 inspectors back in, it wouldn't help them. It would only make things more complicated. They'd be working in parallel, interviewing the same scientists and visiting the same sites. On the other hand, even Washington's allies, Britain and Australia, want to see the U.N. inspectors go back in and verify anything that the U.S. finds because they think it would allay this widespread suspicion out there that the U.S. might somehow plant something. Mm.
France's call for the suspension of trade sanctions is seen by some as a sort of a major shift moving gradually towards the U.S. position. How do you read it?
Well, it is in part a move towards the U.S. position, but it does come with strings attached. It's in France's interest to suspend sanctions as well because it would help them get their businesses and investment back into Baghdad.
Were the French also concerned about their public relations, that they could be positioned as keeping Iraq from reviving its economy?
Absolutely. To be portrayed as the ones who are blocking aid and blocking the recovery of Iraq is very bad PR. So this is, in effect, a PR move. A French diplomat said yesterday that they wanted to send a signal to the Iraqi people that we understand that the situation has changed and they need to be cared for.
Right. And finally, what do you think will happen?
Well, it's interesting to say. If the U.S. continues to get its way, I think that they could do a sort of compromise phasing out of the sanctions. They could also merge the inspection teams so they wouldn't be working in parallel, but actually together. Maybe the U.S. would co-opt the U.N. inspectors somehow. That's speculation, but I'm just looking to see how it might all play out.
When it does, we'll call you again. Maggie, thank you.
Thank you.
Maggie Farley, U.N. correspondent for the L.A. Times. She spoke to us from New York.
American Airlines announced this morning a first quarter net loss of just over $1 billion. Truly dreadful is what CEO Don Carty called it. He's not the only one who's upset. Unionized pilots, flight attendants, and transport workers are furious with Carty. Since finding out that the rank and file approved 15% pay cuts for themselves last week, on the same day that management filed for huge pay and pension perks, board members of AMR, American's parent company, are discussing whether to ditch Carty to help keep the nation's largest airline out of bankruptcy. Joining us on the line now from Dallas is Edward Phillips, the Southwest Bureau Chief for Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine. Welcome, Mr. Phillips.
Good morning.
Mr. Phillips, amid talk of bankruptcy, just how truly dreadful for American are these new numbers?
I think Mr. Carney described it very accurately. Dreadful is exactly what the situation is. American's been beset by a number of financial problems here for the last year or so, as many other airlines have. But American has the most to lose, and I think today is really pushing them very close to some type of immediate decision-making.
Right. The Dallas Morning News is reporting that the airline has canceled a conference call for analysts. Now, what kind of a signal is that?
I think what's going on there behind the scenes is a lot of meetings today, a lot of scrambling and thinking, how should we best handle this? And how can we actually do some good damage control here and then come out with a solution? And I suspect that may happen by the end of the day.
AMR board members, AMR, again, American's parent company, meet tomorrow. How safe is CEO Carty's job?
Well, it's kind of tough to speculate on that. I think Mr. Carty has certainly made every effort to do a good job. And despite that misstep last week as far as revealing things to the unions, but I think he has a good chance of weathering this. On the other hand, I think he has the type of integrity that if the board or he saw that his stepping down might solve the situation, I don't think he would probably be beyond that.
Huh. Now, what about the unions in all this? Can they take back their vote on that concession package?
Well, I believe the latest information I understand anyway is that the pilots, I think, are not going to re-vote. The TWU and the mechanics, I think they're considering that, but the flight attendants have decided that they would like to go ahead and re-vote.
Now,
so that could have a serious effect on this whole thing.
Yeah. Now, the nation's second largest airline, as we know, United, is already in bankruptcy. Could bankruptcy be a way to save American Airlines?
Well, it might save the airline, but it would be another dreadful situation, this time for the unions. Nobody wins in a case like that, because I think there would be thousands of more layoffs, and you would see American shrink quite a bit and come out as a much more lean and mean carrier than they are now. And that's really, I don't think, an alternative that they want to consider, nor do the unions.
Mr. Phillips, in the limited time we have left, can you boil down why American Airlines is in so much trouble?
I think it's just a sign of the times. There's how to do business now, especially after 9/11, when you have a very risk-averse passenger populace. They're concerned about going to the airport. They're concerned about getting on airplanes. And then, of course, the volatile political situation around the world, the whole thing, and you could include SARS on that, too, here lately. But the combination of those things makes it very difficult to roll with the punches. From where Don Carty and the senior management at AMR sit. So it's a very tough and still volatile situation, and there's no easy solution to it. It would take probably another 2 to 3 years before the airline industry is going to return to profitability.
Perfect economic storm. Edward Phillips, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Edward Phillips is Southwest Bureau Chief for Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine.
Just ahead, an American in post-war Kosovo finds a way to speak to people there through Hemingway.
And later in the program, food from the Fertile Crescent. An Iraqi woman in America cooks to overcome loss.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Ernest Hemingway once said that there was no metaphor or symbolism in his book, The Old Man and the Sea. He said simply, the sea is the sea, the fish is the fish. But a group of students studying English as a second language in war-ravaged Kosovo in 2000 might disagree. They did not think of Hemingway's book as a book about fishing. Paula Huntley was their teacher then. Her new book is called The Hemingway Book Club of Kosovo, and she joins us on the line from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to tell us how Albanians in Kosovo came to find Hemingway or even have a book club. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm just fine. In the back of your book, there's a picture of your students from the book club. How did you were not a journalist or a teacher, how did you get to them?
No, my experience was in marketing. I had a marketing job here for 12 years, and my husband got an invitation from the American Bar Association to go help rebuild the legal system there. I was afraid I wouldn't have anything to contribute, but I got a job teaching English as a second language. I had 17 Kosovo Albanians, teenagers up through age 55, and we started the Hemingway Book Club of Kosovo. Which I know sounds very strange in Kosovo after the war.
Had you brought the book? Did someone have the book?
I happened upon the book as an accident. One copy, I'm sure, Robin, the only copy of the book in English in the country, because so much had been destroyed in Kosovo. I happened upon the book, and I remembered vaguely from my high school English, as you may too, that The Old Man and the Sea is a fable. It is a fable of the triumph of the human spirit over loss and adversity. And I thought, this is the perfect book for these Kosovo Albanians. This book is the story of my students' lives. So I got it, I made copies for them, and asked them if they wanted to start this American-style book club, and they jumped at the chance.
Yeah. Remind us of just how broken Kosovo was in 2000.
Oh, my goodness. You know, after the war, the chief prosecutor for the International War Crimes Tribunal went to Kosovo and called the country one vast crime scene. Over half the Albanian homes in the country had been destroyed. Serbs, the ones who were left in the country, many had been driven out in a reverse ethnic cleansing. They were living huddled down lives in a country that didn't want them anymore. The country was practically destroyed, but the people were optimistic, enthusiastic, full of joy and life, probably amazed to be alive. Mm. So this wonderful total incongruity of joy and optimism in the midst of all this destruction.
The thing you decide to do with this place and with this people is introduce them to Hemingway. What was their first reaction in the book club?
You know, the first reaction, once they read part of the book, and we read it just 20 pages at a time, they immediately identified with the old man who, we learn in the first paragraph of The Old Man and the Sea, had gone 84 days without catching a fish. These young people knew about failure, and in particular, at the end of the book, after he caught his great marlin and then lost it to the sharks, they were able to identify with loss, but continuing, going on even after great loss. These students had lost their families, they had lost their homes, and they began to see themselves as the heroes of their own stories, I believe.
Hmm. And Hemingway, as someone who might have been a contemporary, you told them about Hemingway, that he was a journalist, that he covered the Spanish War.
Yes.
And that he would have visited Kosovo and loved it. What made you say that?
You know, I really believe that's true. Hemingway, as you say, covered the Spanish Civil War and then, of course, World War II, where he was present for D-Day and the liberation of Paris. I believe that, and I told the students that I believe Hemingway would have gone to Kosovo in 1998 and 1999 because, mostly, he would have so admired their struggle for freedom. He would have admired the way they kept going even when things looked hopeless. Mm. And I'm quite sure he would have written a wonderful piece about them.
Your diary ends on 2001, but there's an epilogue that's dated February 1st, 2002, and it tells us about one of your students, Leonard. Tell us a little about him.
Well, I admit right off that Leonard was the teacher's pet. He was an 18-year-old boy when I was there. He and his family had lived through the 3 months of the NATO bombing. They were virtual prisoners in their cramped flat. Serbian policemen came time after time and threatened to take Leonard off and kill him. His mother gave them money each time. They lived in fear of the knock on the door. Yet Leonard, even after 10 years of apartheid under Milosevic, even after those 3 months of terror, Leonard is an optimistic, bright young man who hopes more than anything that he will be accepted into an American university. And actually, only today, he and I emailed each other. He is applying to 3 American universities, and I'm helping him with his application, and we are hoping that he will be accepted and will be here in the United States this next fall.
This would be too neat an ending, but do you attribute all this to Hemingway?
Well, you know, the book club was a wonderful thing in itself. Reading the book, The Old Man and the Sea, was a wonderful experience for all of us. The book club, though, had its greatest value in that it was the thing that brought us together with bonds of affection and trust that I don't know if we would have had we just remained a teacher and students in the classroom. We had a great, friendly, fun class, but it was after we started discussing Hemingway in the book club in my home that they became part of my family. They started inviting me into their families, and I began hearing their wonderful, sad, tragic, hopeful stories. So, yes, in that sense, I do attribute this wonderful relationship to the book club and to the fact that we read Hemingway together.
Mm. Well, Paula, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. I appreciate your interest.
Paula Huntley's book is called The Hemingway Book Club of Kosovo. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the World Health Organization says unless it's necessary, people shouldn't go to certain destinations in Asia and Canada. We check on the declining health of the tourism industry.
And issue our poetry challenge. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the no-fly list was drawn up to catch would-be terrorists before boarding a plane. But is it also keeping liberal, anti-war Americans from flying?
And ancient recipes from the Fertile Crescent in the kitchen of an Iraqi exile in America.
The recipe is called the Virgin's Breasts. The recipe goes, make the dough and shape it like breasts. So I just, you know, shaped it like a ball and I stuck a raisin in the middle.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Thousands of Shiite Muslims protested U.S. presence in Iraq today. They took to the streets of the city of Karbala as they wound up a religious pilgrimage in that city. The retired general overseeing post-war Iraq says he's not discouraged by the anti-American demonstration. Jay Garner says the people are exercising their new freedom and predicts the country will be back on its feet faster than expected. Garner is visiting the city of Erbil, administrative capital of Iraq's Kurdish region. Iraq's crude oil pipelines are filling again for the first time since the start of the U.S.-led war. No word yet on when oil exports could resume. Associated Press correspondent Lourdes Navarro has more.
General Robert Creer, the top U.S. official charged with getting Iraq's oil production up and running, says that coalition forces aided by Iraqi oil workers have fired up a gas oil separation plant. That plant sent oil to a pumping station and storage tank outside the key southern city of Basra. Officials had planned to pump the oil to a refinery, but unexploded ordnance near the pipeline made that unfeasible for now. Within 6 to 15 weeks, one of the country's largest southern fields could be producing up to 1.1 million barrels a day. The country's northern oil fields remain out of commission. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
The White House is warning Iran not to interfere with the creation of a new democracy in Iraq. The warning comes after reports that Iranian agents are infiltrating southern Iraq and working to promote Shiite Muslim clerics and advance Iranian interests. A deadlock of several days over the makeup of the Palestinian cabinet is over. Prime Minister-designate Mahmoud Abbas has presented his selections to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The agreement keeps a U.S.-backed peace plan on track. All public schools in the Chinese capital of Beijing have been temporarily shut down as the nation tries to deal with an outbreak of the deadly SARS virus. Nearly 2 million students have been ordered to stay home for 2 weeks. SARS has killed at least 28 people in Beijing. Meanwhile, experts with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are in Toronto to try and help keep the virus from spreading in hospitals there. On Wall Street today, the Dow is up 9 points at 84.94. The Nasdaq is up 12 points at 14.63. It's now 33 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Two peace activists from San Francisco want to know how they wound up on a secret no-fly list created by the federal government. Rebecca Gordon and Janet Adams were among more than 300 travelers detained at San Francisco Airport during the past 2 years. Now, a lawsuit filed on their behalf yesterday by the ACLU requests a judge to force the FBI, the Transportation Security Administration, or the Justice Department to disclose just who's on the list and how their names got there. Barry Steinhardt is the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program in New York. Welcome, Mr. Steinhardt.
Thank you.
Mr. Steinhardt, what happened to Rebecca Gordon and Janet Adams when they showed up for their flight in San Francisco?
Well, they were told that they were on the no-fly list, and they were subjected to additional searches. They've now gone through a horrific process of trying to get additional details about why it is that they're on the no-fly list, and even trying to get the government to confirm that there is a no-fly list, the federal government, that is. Finally, we were able to obtain documents from the city of San Francisco that made it quite clear that not only is there a no-fly list, but that they were on that list.
And they never flew.
Well, you know, they've been able to fly. I mean, you have people who are on this so-called no-fly list, some of whom have been able to fly, others who've had their flights delayed. There are business travelers for whom flight has become essentially impossible because of the hassle, because their employers don't want them to be subjected to these kinds of surges. This is all, you know, to some extent, mysterious. We're in a time in our country now where we've got the worst of both worlds. We not only have intrusive government, but we have secret government. And we have to guess as to whether we're on no-fly list and why.
So you say there are peace activists on the list, but also business people and others. How many are on this list?
Well, I wish I knew. That's what we're trying to find out. It's difficult to even get the Transportation Security Administration to admit that there is a no-fly list, but clearly it does exist.
You imagine hundreds on the list? Or?
Oh, there certainly are hundreds on the list. Well, we don't know the full extent of the list. And I don't believe, actually, that there is a single list. There were lists that were distributed to the airlines after September 11th, and they seem to have, to some extent, taken a life of their own. You can even find versions of them out on the net. So there's no question that there are many people who are on some version of a no-fly list.
Any reason to think that peace activists have been particularly targeted?
We don't know. I mean, the simple truth of the matter is we don't know. We'd like to know why our two clients are on this list. Is it because they're peace activists? There is some reason to believe that that may have been the case, but we don't know why they're on the list. They're not on the list because they're foreign terrorists, which we're told is the focus of the list. So we would like to know why they're on the list. It appears to us that they are on the list deliberately. This was not clerical error in their cases. There's lots of clerical errors, but these apparently are not examples of clerical errors. The only conclusion we can draw at this point is that they're on the list because of their political activities. If the government has another explanation for that, it better come forward with it.
Aren't extraordinary measures necessary in extraordinary times, and aren't mistakes inevitably made?
Sure, extraordinary measures may be necessary, but the illusion of security is the worst thing we can possibly do here. If we have a list that is essentially flawed, then not only are you going to be resulting in people losing their liberty, people getting hassled, people being less free, but we're going to be diverting the resources of our security personnel at airports and other settings. That's the illusion of security is not our friend here. It's our enemy. And the last thing we want is the government hassling a couple of women because they're peace activists instead of concentrating on the terrorists that they know exist out there. They have information about them. So as a frequent flyer, I can tell you that it's galling to see examples of illusory security because I want to be safe up there.
Barry Steinhardt, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Barry Steinhardt is the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program in New York. Now we turn to Brian Termael, a spokesperson with the Transportation Security Administration. He's agreed to talk about the no-fly list, but not about that ACLU lawsuit that's now before the courts. Hello, Mr. Termael.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for having me. And I do wish I could speak about the particular lawsuit, but obviously there are a number of rules that govern what the federal government can say about a pending claim or lawsuit, and it just would not be appropriate to comment on it. But certainly happy to answer your questions. And I think, if I may, it's best to preface the conversation and listening to Barry's comments. It's clear that there's some misunderstanding. To explain a little bit of what this no-fly list is, and more importantly, what it isn't, if that's all right by you.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, we want to know essentially how many people are on the no-fly list and how you get your name there.
Fair enough. Let me tell you what it is. And this is something that predates September 11th. A range of federal government intelligence agencies have for some time in the United States provided to first the Federal Aviation Administration and now to the Transportation Security Administration a list of individuals who are threats to civil aviation or who are foreign terrorists or associated with foreign terrorism. This is a list that after TSA was created, we assumed responsibility for implementing. And if I can take a cheap shot at the government, and I know I'm part of the government, let me just say that we're not very original. So when we come up with a name like the no-fly list, it's a quite literal name. That means if you're on the no-fly list, if you're a threat to civil aviation, if you are a foreign terrorist, you do not ever receive a boarding pass in the United States. And that's not the issue that we're discussing here. What we're talking about are a range of individuals who receive boarding passes and fly. The problem here, and it is a problem, and it's one that we're working and have some measures I'd like to talk about to address. The problem here are individuals who are not on the no-fly list, but because of software that airlines have decided on their own to use in implementing the no-fly list, they're accidentally identifying individuals because they have maybe two, maybe three, maybe four similar letters in their name to those individuals who are on the no-fly list.
So I'm going to interrupt.
What happens, this supposed extra level of security that they're going through is actually the airlines working to identify who these travelers are to confirm that they're not terrorists and they're not foreign or threats to civil aviation.
So you're not targeting peace activists
Once these issues are resolved, these individuals are issued boarding passes. No, absolutely not. That's a notion that is a horrible urban myth and really doesn't do anyone justice. The folks who are working to keep terrorists and threats to civil aviation off of the commercial airliners and doesn't do any justice to the folks who every day travel. Obviously, everything the TSA is going to do is going to be done with the utmost respect for the privacy and the rights of the traveling public. We have never, will never, and absolutely refuse to consider the notion of someone involved in their rightful responsibility and obligation to express their opinions in the United States from being included on the no-fly list. And I think there's a significant fact in this discussion that's worth bringing up. To date, the Transportation Security Administration has never heard from any individual who is actually on the no-fly list to say, hey, what gives? I shouldn't be on here. And that's because those folks are terrorists and they're threats to civil aviation. And they know we've got a measure that's going to keep them from flying and possibly harming women and children, innocent civilians on board commercial aircraft.
Brian Tamale, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
I'm so sorry to be long-winded, but I think these issues are really important. I think there's a lot of misinformation, and I think people have an obligation and a right to know what we're doing and why we are taking the steps we are to keep them safe.
Thanks very much. Brian Tamale, a spokesperson with the Transportation Security Administration in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Now, a story about a family's grief, compounded by a torturous, confusing, and long journey through the legal system. Shortly after Dylan Keene was born in 1986 at a Massachusetts hospital, he suffered an infection that left him irreparably brain damaged. Dylan Keene is now 16. Earlier this year, a state appellate court awarded the Keene family $4 million in damages. But yesterday, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court struck that award down, declaring state law caps damages against charities, nonprofit institutions like the hospital in question, Brigham and Women's. Instead of $4 million, the Keene family will receive the cap on damages against a charitable organization of $20,000. Joining us now on the line to explain more about this case is Chris Milne, attorney for the Keene family. Welcome, Chris.
Hello, Bill.
Chris, the hospital records were lost, and that's why the lower court awarded the family $4 million. Yes? Can you explain that?
Yes. It's just, you know, really an unbelievable situation. At 5 hours of life, Dylan had been born a normal infant. His APGAR scores were fine, and he had the start of an infection. And what the Keens learned years later when they got the records and had them reviewed to figure out what had happened with their son, that at that point in time, a blood test had been taken at 5 hours of age, and there was a plan to hold antibiotics pending that blood test. The records for the next 18 to 20 hours were, you know, you kind of put in quotes, missing. And what happened to Dylan during that 20-hour period is unknown, other than at the end of that 20-hour period, he was in septic shock, near death, and, you know, suffered the profound brain damage that stayed with him and has for his life, making a very difficult situation for his family.
So was the $4 million awarded for negligence, or it seems because the records were lost?
The way in Massachusetts you're able to recover and get compensation for the astronomical cost of care of a child like Dylan is to sue individual doctors and nurses. And with the loss of those records, the identities of the doctors and nurses who treated Dylan was lost, and I think I have two filing cabinets in my office to try to find other ways to see who the doctors were. We weren't able to do that, so the hospital was the only responsible party, and the court found the hospital would be defaulted because we lost our ability to prove the case and then awarded compensatory damages.
So the appellate court awarded damages because you had no way to sue for negligence.
Yes.
Of course, the capping law exists to prevent hospitals from going under financially with massive awards.
Well, I mean, that really just isn't a factor in this case. I mean, that's an issue that's under debate, you know, medical malpractice. I mean, this is a case where really the basic thing you would expect when your child is born and something like this happens, to know, you know, who his doctor was, what happened to him, where was he? Was he in the NICU? Was he in the regular care nursery? Those answers were never and will never be given.
How has this affected the Keene family?
For a child like Dylan, whose the costs are just incredible, lawsuits like this provide a means to get funding for nursing and other costs of his care that aren't otherwise provided, and it's hard for them.
Is the Supreme Judicial Court your court of last resort?
We're looking at that. It is a question of state law. This charitable immunity cap is a Massachusetts statute which, you know, in 1969 was described as arcane and of no longer valid use, and for some reason the legislature in 1972 enacted it again in Massachusetts. So, it looks like that's the end of it for them, as hard as it is to say.
Thank you very much, Chris Milne.
Thank you, Bill.
Attorney Chris Milne represents the Keene family in Massachusetts. We contacted Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston regarding this story, but officials said they had no comment.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The U.S. sugar industry is asking Congress to consider pulling funding for the U.N.'s World Health Organization because the WHO is set to recommend that people eat less sugar than the industry would like. Joining us on the line from London is Sarah Bowlesley. She's the health editor of the Guardian newspaper. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello, welcome.
We understand the WHO is recommending that 10% of daily diet be free sugar or sugar added to drink and food. The sugar industry says it should be 25%. So could you first illustrate that for us? You know, how many sodas is that, or how many candies?
25% of sugar is one quarter of your total food intake. So that means that virtually everything you consume is going to have some sugar in it. What you're really talking about here is a lot of processed food, a lot of Coca-Colas, a lot of soft drinks with sugar added to them. We're not just talking about teaspoons of sugar in your tea.
Right. We actually hear that the 10% might be something like a bag of M&Ms, while the 25% would be three packages of M&Ms. So it's quite a bit.
Right.
Well, the U.S. sugar lobby is part of a worldwide sugar lobby critical of the WHO. But that organization does a lot of different work. For the sugar lobby to ask Congress to discontinue funding seems like an extreme action. Why? What's at stake?
What is at stake is their industry's profitability, essentially. It's not just the Sugar Association, although those are the people who are really fronting this and wrote the letter threatening the funding of the WHO. There are a lot of processed food groups and soft drinks industries who really agree with them, and they do not want this restriction from 25% of the diet to 10% of the diet. They have said that they will fight this by every means available.
And they've also said that they don't think that it's accurate. A letter states, taxpayers' dollars should not be used to support misguided, non-science-based reports. But in fact, the sugar industry is also maintained in part by taxpayers. Congress has long had a sugar support program. It guarantees a minimum price by restricting imports, and it buys and stores excess sugar. It costs Americans billions in inflated sugar prices.
Yes, which is why it rather makes a nonsense of the position of the sugar industry, that they are protecting those industries, sugar growers and their families in developing countries, which they say are the primary audiences for WHO programs.
And one last question, Sarah. Do people really react to a WHO report, you know, when they decide what they're going to eat?
I think it isn't so much about the individual. It's about the companies who are giving us processed foods. And there's pressure on them to limit the amount of sugar that is actually in their foods through guidelines like these. So in the long term, we'll all benefit.
Or if the sugar lobby wins, there's going to be a lot more sugar in your cereal.
Well, there is a lot of sugar in your cereal at the moment. In fact, if you look at the actual amounts in there, you'd be surprised. You know, I looked at my packet of cereal the other day, and there's more. The sugar is actually the second component, even though it's not one of those added sugar cereals at all. So there's a lot of sugar in our diet already. We're probably already consuming more than 25% of our diet in sugar, very many of us. Mm. And with the obesity epidemic going on as it is, we really do need to cut down. So this would help us without us even really realizing it by the if there were changes to the way that these foods are made.
Well, Sarah, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Sarah Bosley is health editor of the Guardian newspaper. She spoke to us from London.
The scent of spices fill the tiny apartment of Nawal Nasrallah outside of Boston.
Well, what else? Okay, cumin. I have cumin here. Cinnamon, curry powder, chili pepper, and turmeric. Yeah, we use turmeric a lot. It has been used for thousands of centuries. I've seen.
Nawal Nasrallah escaped Iraq with her family the day Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990. She grew up in Baghdad and learned how to cook the same stews, stuffed meat pies, and flatbreads typical of Iraq cuisine today and for millennia. Nasrallah did years of research and found many recipes from ancient cuneiform tablets discovered in an archaeology site south of Baghdad in the 1930s. They're considered the world's oldest recorded recipes from 1700 BC. In her exhaustive work called Delights from the Garden of Eden, Nasrallah recounts the stories behind this ancient culinary tradition. Her book, which is self-published, came out a few weeks before the U.S. began bombing in Iraq. Recently, Nawal Nasrallah explained the inspiration behind her work to WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum.
Things happened in my life, and I wanted to really, you know, to find something to keep me busy. And I was having difficulties dealing with food because, you know, they were just overloaded with sad memories and all that. So,
what do you mean?
Because my son passed away in the summer of 1996. He was just 13 years old. So it was that Christmas break in 1996 that I started my research. And from then till now, I have been busy, you know, with it all the time. I wanted to do something that would keep his memory alive, so to write it and dedicate it to him, and this is what I did. Really, you know, you can trace the present traditions back to the Mesopotamian times. The recipes I found in the Babylonian recipes, they have so much in common with what we are doing these days. Our tradition is so ancient. Actually, my initial, the title of the book was not Delights from the Garden of Eden. It was What's Cooking in Mesopotamia Then and Now. That was the original title. But then, you know, with all the politics and all that, I thought people might think that I am being sarcastic. You know, what's cooking in Mesopotamia? What's Saddam doing? I want also to tell you about a cookie I found in one of those medieval cookbooks. It is like almond cookies, but the recipe in the medieval cookbook is called the Virgin's Breasts. The recipe goes, make the dough and shape it like breasts. I didn't know. So I just, you know, shaped it like a ball, and I stuck a raisin in the middle. So I improvised. Now I'm going to put the drumsticks in a Pyrex. Yeah. Oven-proof Well, I really wanted this book for the generation that is growing up outside Iraq. I would really like them to keep the tradition going because it's such a beautiful tradition, and it's a pity that it would be lost.
I'm arranging the drumsticks. This rice, the fava bean rice, is boiling now. You can listen to it. This meal, I can say, goes back 5,000 years ago, even more, because you have the broth with lamb, which was cooked in ancient Mesopotamia. We have the chicken, the fava beans, the rice. They were cooked during the medieval times, and they are still cooking now. The same tradition has been cooking in the region all along, ever since thousands of years.
We can just take some and pass it around.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm.
What would you like to toast to?
Swift peas.
Yeah, swift peas. It's all on our minds.
Nawal Nasrallah's cookbook is called Delights from the Garden of Eden, a cookbook and a history of the Iraqi cuisine. She spoke to WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum. For more information, check out our website at here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest news.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com. MathWorks.com.